My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this nine-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello, this is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and I am your host, Liv, back from 2 months away in Greece. Not that you guys would know it because I've been releasing episodes this entire time, but finally, I'm recording things, like, closer to the when they're being aired, you know, so I don't have to account for all of the horror that'll happen in the world in the interim. Which I'm not going to get into now because I traveled for 27 hours just the other day and I'm not ready for that. And, well, I'm here in this moment because I had a different episode that was scheduled to air, a conversation, but I can no longer air that conversation for reasons I will not get into. But what it means is I came back from my 2 month trip and 10 hours time difference to have one single day to fix this issue in time for an episode to air. And instead of trying to race and put out something that wasn't quite as perfect as I want it to be, I've chosen to air an absolute fan favorite episode. The time last year that I spoke with Kyle Lewis Jordan about Hephaestus, but about Hephaestus as a disabled god. One of the most fascinating and important episodes that I have done on this show. It is part one of two. So in this episode's description, you will find a link to part two, as well as a link to the episodes I did on Hephaestus as a god and his mythology to accompany these, because this spawned a real resurgence in my appreciation of Hephaestus, and I'm just excited to share this with you all again. So please sit back and enjoy this episode from last year with Kyle Lewis Jordan. And next week I will be back with something new. Conversations. Who really is Hephaestus? Disability in Greek Myth with Kyle Lewis Jordan. Thank you so much for being here. So why don't you start by telling us kind of what you study and you know, what your interests are in this realm?
I am a postgraduate student at University College London's Institute of Archaeology, currently researching the archaeology and heritage of Egypt and the Middle East. I am a disabled person. I have cerebral palsy. And that obviously informs my work. I broadly focus on the realms of religion, magic, and identity in the Egyptian world, but with a specific focus on the representation and approaches to disability. And I'm currently, my thesis topic is actually looking at the role and significance of disability and bodily difference in pharaonic court society. So I do a lot basically around the body and representations of disability, hence why, despite not being trained as a classicist, I take a lot of interest in Hephaestus. And my dissertation was on a comparative analysis of approaches between Egypt and Greece. So Hephaestus was one of the key focuses of that, and my interest in him kind of from the sidelines has only grown.
Yeah. So, I mean, well, then we'll just jump right in. So, I mean, I'm happy to talk about, I mean, whatever and all of, you know, what you study when it comes to this, because I think it all sounds fascinating and, you know, something that doesn't probably get talked a lot in terms of outside of academic circles specific to that topic. So I think that's really important. But specifically Hephaestus, I mean, that's why you're here. I think Hephaestus is so interesting. And, you know, as a person who, you know, is not disabled, I've never focused much on his disability besides, you know, pointing out how problematic the translations have been. You know, he just go right out and say it, like he's always described as like the lame god, which is
the lame
so
god.
Dark, it, you know, in so many ways. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of where I've gone with that. But my focus is always on him as just such a shitty guy when it comes to like Aphrodite and Ares.
Yeah, this is definitely one of the complicated things, and one that, you know, I recently have gotten into a few conversations of. And to be absolutely clear, you're not wrong to see him as a shitty guy. Like none of what I kind of try and get people to think about is try to absolve him, quote unquote, or to make you feel sympathetic. I don't think he's a Olympian. He doesn't need your sympathy. So like, you know, like he is like still capable of being just a shitty person as the rest of them, or shitty being, I should say. But effectively, what I do try and get across more so, and this kind of comes in with the translation and all about reception, so that ties in nicely with the most recent episode with Dr. Austin, is the idea of like how that is perceived both by the Greeks themselves and by us today and in the many intervening years since. Yeah. I mean, even by the Romans, like kind of time when they came to prominence and were starting to mess around with the Greek myths, they had some very interesting kind of takes on Vulcan, as they call them. I mean, namely by erasing the disability entirely, almost.
Interesting.
Like they never really acknowledge it. Obviously, you still get the stories of, for them, obviously Venus and Mars and the cuckolding, as it gets referred to by some scholars. But, you know, it is his clubbed foot, as it's often kind of agreed amongst scholars. That's okay. Like if you were to decide the embodiment of his impairment, that is how it would often be referred to, as a clubbed foot. Sometimes in translation it gets referred to as a crooked foot or a lame foot, but again, that's very dated and just very as you said, not great. I mean, this is the actually this might be a good place to start, and that is that in a lot of reception of Hephaestus, especially more modern, and when I say modern, I don't just mean today, I mean like say in the last few centuries or so, you know, because if we think on the time span of ancient to today, that's quite a lot of time, so modern is quite relative. But like the presentation of Hephaestus is often like he gets what I like to be referred to as Quasimodo'd. Like he gets made to be a lot more effectively, for lack of a better word, monstrous than he really was, even to the Greeks. I mean, like in Hesiod's Theogony, like literally the description that we're given of him, I mean, it isn't even a physical description. It literally says that Hera kind of gave birth to him out of fury and frustration with Zeus for birthing Athena. And that will be something that will come up much later, I imagine, if we do talk about Hephaestus and Athena, because there's a lot there as well.
Oh, yes.
But yeah, it literally just says, gave birth to the renowned Hephaestus, who is endowed with skills beyond all the celestials. So all it says is that he is a very well-endowed god, and that he obviously has this great skill. It doesn't say anything about being gross or deformed, and in fact in his physical descriptions from various other sources, the general gist that you get is that while he does have this clubbed foot and he has some weakness in his legs, generally otherwise he's described as having a rather large torso, a rather thick neck, and a hairy chest. That's it. He doesn't in the rest of his description, he is pretty much what you would imagine an Olympian to be in every possible way, except for the one way that his mother rejected him for, which was his crooked foot. And and that I find just really interesting to think of how, from then to now, how he has been shaped and changed into this far more sort of grotesque sort of individual, and what that says really about what we perceive when we think of it. And this is where this is why I was so interested in Hephaestus, because when I would notice him, and the first time I started getting into kind of the ancient world, and I saw him, like I remember going to the British Museum for the first time, and you see the Parthenon frieze in the gallery, and you see him represented on the frieze, and he has the walking stick, and you think to yourself, the kind of crutch, rather, sorry, to be more specific, and you think, oh, that's interesting, because when you think of Olympians, you obviously think of the very perfect, the very kind of just peak power sort of beings, and then you see Hephaestus, and then you would ask, I would ask my professors when I was doing ancient history and Egyptology for my undergrad, so it was a dual honours between history and archaeology, and in archaeology is where I did all the Egyptology, and basically in the history is where I learned about the history of the Near East and of Greece and Rome, and whenever I'd talk to my Greek professors and ask them about what they thought about Hephaestus, the response I would generally get was they would ask, they would say that, that's just to reflect the nature of being a smith in the ancient world, because it could be quite crippling work. And that is true. That is not untrue by any means. And I don't want to say that that isn't part of it, but I somehow struggle to believe that a choice to represent an Olympian with that kind of embodiment didn't have something more to say. And so when I think about it, and when we think, kind of going back to what I was saying about his conception, so as I said, like, he is conceived by Hera after witnessing Zeus conceive Athena. And in Hera's way of how sick of her husband's shit she is like, okay, fine, I can do this, and I'm going to make him even better. I'm going to make a great and powerful god of my own. And she does, by all intents and purposes. She makes, I would argue, for my money, one of the most powerful gods on Olympus, as we can also get into. But like, I think, yeah, it's just, he is perfect in all the ways that he was meant to be, except for the way that Hera wants him to be. And that's why she throws him off off Olympus, and it goes from there. So yeah.
Well, and what's interesting too about him and that whole birth story, because, you know, I always have to come back to this idea that Zeus conceived Athena, which is actually bullshit, right? Like, you know, somebody like, you know, I don't know who it appears. It must be like the Homeric hymn or something, because like you say, I mean, you know, it's a little bit less in Hesiod, though I suppose it was more about that and less about his disability in Hesiod. But
yeah,
regardless, like, you know, Zeus does not conceive Athena. Zeus eats her mother.
Yes.
And thus gives birth to her, which is so similar to, you know, Dionysus is sometimes used as an example of that as well. But he also killed her mother and then sewed him up in his thigh. You know, like, Zeus did not create anyone on his own, whereas Hera actually did, you know, and not only that, but like you're saying, like one of the most important gods from a practical standpoint, you know, I mean, he was important all around, but the practicality of Hephaestus's importance is huge, right? Like everything about what he did was huge, was so important to the daily world of the ancient Greeks. And so, you know, he was so important. He was so perfect. And Hera created him all on her own. So I like to, you know, go back to that because I think it's, I mean, she handles it poorly. Though I think there are some sources that suggest that Zeus threw him off.
There is that. Anger. There are variations of that. As is typical in myth, you will find variations. There is also a variation to the creation of Athena that it features Hephaestus. In my reading, there is a great one where basically, because as you said, Zeus eats Athena's mother. And so then Athena being born, kind of decides, well, I'm going to go sit in the place of reason, which is the head, and then she gives him a massive headache. Now, what I like to imagine is basically Athena is like, oh my god, what is in here? And so basically just starts lambasting him from inside, so he's got a splitting headache. And in this version of the story, Hephaestus is basically tasked with like fixing it, so he just gets a massive great axe and just whacks him on the head. And what I like to imagine is he's standing there behind the throne of Zeus about to give him a massive whack, and the one time Hera's proud of him for taking a whack at Zeus, she's just like, yeah, you go, hit him so hard that the Titans and Tartarus can hear it. There you go, he hits his head, and so comes forth Athena. And I think obviously from that moment in that variation of the myth, that's where their partnership kind of begins, because it's from that moment that, you know, he just kind of has that affinity for her. And yeah, but that is true. There are many variations, but I think the general consensus is that he gets thrown from Olympus. In some variations, he'll fall straight into the ocean, and that is where he is rescued by Thetis and the other Oceanids, and they take care of him and teach him the ways of his craft. In other slight variations, he falls on the island of Lemnos, and it is there that he is taken care of and protected by the Kabiri, I think, is the local people. They are a kind of a mythic people who are basically renowned for their metalwork. So there comes in the connection with his ability to shape metal, which is actually obviously a very significant skill. And it's not just the fact that he can shape it, but as we'll probably go on to explore, it's the fact that he can give it life as well. He can give it motion. But yeah, it's there that he falls to Lemnos or into the ocean. Either way, he is very close to volcanoes, and that obviously ties in with his nature. He is very closely associated with volcanoes. And if you think of their very violent nature, if the way we imagine volcanoes, obviously their eruptions and things like that, that almost in a way, along with Hera's own anger at the moment that she was conceiving him, because again, her frustration with Zeus, ties in very much with his nature as well. He's a very, in most cases, he is described as a very kind of fierce, sort of very, very, very ill-tempered god. And that obviously ties in with what we were saying earlier, that he is not a very, very good at handling certain scenarios, as we'll go on to mention, I'm sure. But that is a very interesting thing that I think is worth exploring as well, his relationship with anger. And I think, I mean, this comes from a much later source, but in the 2nd century AD, Greek diviners used to say that women who were angry at birth or at the point of conception, either way round, could give birth to disabled children. That was essentially one thing that was kind of said to happen. So whichever came first in thought, because again, this is 2nd century AD, so whether they got this idea later on or whether this was an idea that had lasted a long time, either way, it's interesting, I think, to see the connection between the two, perhaps, that this idea is that he was born with this clubbed foot, which is uncharacteristic of other Olympians because of his mother's anger. And so that often, of course, defines their relationship and the kind of on and off relationship that they have, mostly on Hephaestus's side, where he really wants the affection of his mother, but there are some times where he just can't stand her. And, you know, he refers to her in the Iliad, I think, as his dog-faced mother, which is like a very strong turn of phrase. And there's also a great story whereby, because obviously there's the story of the Golden Throne, which he makes for her, that binds her, and that's how he kind of bargains his way back into Olympus. But there's also, he makes her a pair of adamantine sandals, and she puts them on, and she immediately falls flat on her face. And I just like, part of me just can't help but imagine Hephaestus just being very petty and just be like, yes.
I mean, so, he was a petty man, if he's anything, like all of the stories.
he does come across as incredibly petty. That is very true. Yeah, but yeah, no, so there we go. We have these kind of his obviously embodiment of his clubbed foot. Mm-hmm. But then the relationship that has with his anger as well, and what that means. And it kind of comes across in modern reception too. I mean, I don't know how much you've played video games, but like, you know, you have games series like God of War, where in God of War 3, Hephaestus plays quite a prominent role because he is the agonized, tortured kind of god who's sitting in his forge. He kind of helps Kratos, the player character, through his task of defeating the other Olympians, and eventually turns on him. But that's just God of War for you. And then, but there's also the more recent one, which I haven't played, but Dr. Kira Jones has told me about this in Immortals Phoenix Rising. Basically, you're helping each of the gods regain their powers, and for Hephaestus, his power is tied to his anger. Like, he is basically in the game, he has lost his anger, he is now a contented person, but that contentment means he's no longer really able to do the things that he's supposed to do. Like, so that's a very interesting thing in terms of modern reception, how intimately he's kind of conceived with his anger, and that without it he is apparently not really the god he's supposed to be, which I think is very interesting. But bear in mind, obviously, I'm reading this as a disabled person, and for disabled people, relationship with anger is a very, very intimate thing as well. You know, the characterization of disabled people as always angry or always bitter is very, very hard thing to navigate, because if you do show any anger, people will just automatically kind of just assume, oh, you know, they're just another bitter disabled person. So it's very, yeah. therefore when I read Hephaestus, I always do kind of have that lens in mind, and so I'm always like, you know, but it is interesting.
Well, that is fascinating, the idea of the, you know, belief. Gosh, some of the things that they believed back then, but the belief that an angry woman could give birth to a disabled child. I mean, of course, you know, it's always the fault of the woman too, which is something that obviously is the thing I get most connected to. But yeah, that's fascinating. I think Hephaestus is so interesting because I do think that, like, you know, again, as somebody coming at it from you know, the side of non-disability, they don't make obvious connections to his disability when it comes to his shitty character, which is I would see a good thing.
Yeah.
Like, it's his shittiness seems to be totally separate. Like, he's just a guy who, you know, and I think, you know, that he took some hard times in his life regardless, like, and, you know, maybe that just shaped certain things, but I find his character just to be entertaining in the way that he, you know, chooses to express his anger and his frustrations, and it creative in a way that is just, like, you know, fun to read about, between the Golden Throne, the sandals, you know, the way that the Golden Throne then gets him married to Aphrodite, and, like, you know, it's a fascinating thing. But then when you have this connection to the disability of it, and then, you know, add to it, like the modern reception you were talking about of Quasimodoing him, which is a powerful word to use to describe it, when he really isn't described as anything of that sort. He's just, you know, I think to me he comes off a little bit more as, I think the development of the gods, the mythology, the Olympians specifically, are such good representations of the way that the Greeks saw them as human, as, you know, embodying all these very human characteristics, you know, to the point where, you know, they would have seen disabled people amongst their community, and then, you know, they have a disabled god in a way that he is not unable to do anything. He just, you know, has this disability, and, you know, but ultimately is, like, this wildly powerful and important god. And I find that incredibly fascinating. And then just the way, though, that I think, like, certainly modern reception has made it incredibly, like, way, you know, more problematic than it was back then.
I think obviously part of it comes in with obviously just how the changing attitudes towards the embodiment of disability, so impairments, physical difference, has obviously changed over the years, and I mean that also obviously complicates our reading of these tales of Hephaestus and things, because it's actually interesting that you bring up humor and obviously entertaining in some of his days. He is a cunning god. He is he is very crafty and very he does like to scheme, especially when he's trying to get revenge on people. And there is meant to be a degree of humor in that. And I mean, disability in terms of its embodiments and its impairments does feature in Greek humor quite a bit. I mean, in terms of Hephaestus, what I think, the way I read it as a disabled man and as a disabled academic who studies the kind of interpretations and reflections upon disability in an ancient world context, so attitudes essentially towards and what that says about that society's own kind of feelings about their own body, because obviously it and mind in a way you can expand it further, but the mind is obviously even harder to get into. The body itself is already kind of, the ancient body is already kind of disseminated across time. Like obviously when we think of the classical world today, we're thinking of more so the Renaissance sculptures than the actual sculptures themselves, or they're thinking of the body in the same way that obviously the mind is even farther disseminated. Like I mean, nowadays you do get these great studies of the histories of emotion in the ancient world. Obviously Greek emotion is a great subject. Like I mean, the Iliad, just as one example, is just a story that is all about emotion from beginning to end, from various different vantage points, which has been taken advantage of for great retellings in a modern context. But also I think often we forget how central the body was and still is to our own kind of embodiment within the world, how we think of the world and ourselves because of it. And so I do think, well, I guess another way to kind of extrapolate on this idea is to actually kind of get to the nuts and bolts of why I think you can call Hephaestus a disabled god, because to most modern kind of reception of disability in both the terms of how it's studied in antiquity, most scholars think of disability as by the social model of disability, which, just to briefly explain, is basically a model which, counter to what's called the medical model, the idea being that that the person who has the disability is the sole kind of almost problem of the thing. It's all within your own body and therefore has to be medically treated, fixed, quote unquote, in order to kind of be part of society. The social model, in as simple as an explanation as I can give, basically looks at society as the ones who create the barriers that force disabled people with their impairments. So there is a separation between the impairment and the disability. To have to struggle, essentially. And so, you know, it's the breaking down of those barriers that will eventually, hopefully, remove the disablement. So I would often argue that the ancient world is a bit difficult to apply the social model or even the medical model to, because these are models that were designed to address our much more present moment in the realities of the world we live in today. That doesn't mean that they're useless in our historical inquiries, nor is it a fault of those models. Those models were designed for a very specific purpose, but that purpose was never to encapsulate the full breadth and depth of what it is like to live as a disabled person. But if there was one scenario where I could think in the ancient world where the social model actually does prove a point, I would actually say it is Hephaestus. Because, so as I said earlier, he has this clubbed foot, but that's it. But he is an Olympian still. He has all this great talent. He has all this great power. And he shows himself to be one of the most powerful gods on Olympus by his own craft, which they utilize for their own ends to ensure their dominion over the rest of the kind of divine world of Greece. Obviously, he forges their weapons and armor that they use to fend off many foes, the Gigantomachy, all those sorts of other threats and stuff. He forges, obviously, their homes on Olympus. He creates all sorts of things. And like I said earlier, he has the power to give life to inanimate things. He uses the fire of the forge, because he has this special affinity with fire, to be able to breathe life into things that otherwise would not. And that's quite significant, because that means he's kind of outside of that kind of natural cycle of fertility. He doesn't need to be part of that. He can create life without that, which makes him quite powerful as far as the other gods go. But it's also his power to bind as well, which is a key thing, is that by being able to bind these other powerful beings, i.e. Hera, Aphrodite and Ares, he has control over them in a way. And that, I think, is obviously quite a threat to the others. So when he's bargaining to get back into Olympus, I think, you know, this is obviously my interpretation. That's obviously key to bring in. Mm-hmm. But I think there is some conscious acknowledgement on the part of the other gods to be like, maybe we should bring him in, because otherwise, if he keeps going like this, that could be a real danger to the rest of us. And in fact, it's obviously he knows that they can't like free Hera any other way. So it's kind of a conceit on their part that, yes, he's the only way we're going to get her out. And we need to get her out, because otherwise it will be of harm to her otherwise. You know, they have to bring him in. So how do you disable him as well? Because the other thing is you know, his mobility in and of itself. Like, while we do have scenes of him struggling, most notably, obviously, the beginning of the Iliad, where he's to-ing and fro-ing and huffing and puffing and delivering the drinks, to which the gods are laughing. Mm. Otherwise, his mobility is actually doesn't seem to present much of an issue, because, of course, he creates these mobility aids for himself in order to get around. So there is, obviously, his automatons who help him around the forge and are capable of doing jobs for him as well. There is literally, I can't remember where, I apologize, but there are attestations where he is claimed to have created the wheeled chair. It's more like a chariot than a chair, but it's still cool that it gets translated as wheelchair. I like that. Yeah. I like just to think that he is the one who created it. But he basically, his mobility isn't actually an issue unless it's the Olympians themselves that make it an issue. Think again to the start of the Iliad. They're the ones making him deliver the drinks in that way. So how do you disable him then? Because by all accounts, he doesn't seem very disabled. I would argue he's disabled by the fact that the other Olympians, in order to keep him in some form of check, essentially, they torment him. And like I said earlier, you have that example of him being forced to do physical labor that they know he will struggle to do. But they expect him to conform to the Olympian ideal, which, like the social model of disability, society is expecting disabled people to conform to what they can't instead of adapting for their needs. So in the same way, the Olympians are expecting Hephaestus to be as Olympian as they wanted him to be, but he obviously cannot in his own way. And that is what disables him. And it goes further. Like I said earlier, he can bind. And Zeus, being the also very cunning, very conniving bastard that he is, essentially forces Hephaestus, or maybe forces is the wrong word. Deceives him into binding Prometheus. And Prometheus is his kinsman. So the two are quite close. So and Hephaestus laments having to do this. He laments having to bind his own kinsman, because he knows how dangerous and how harmful that is to someone he really cares about. In the same way, going to that story of Aphrodite and Ares and his reaction to that whole thing. Now, obviously, it goes without saying, as we kind of alluded to earlier, that is a massive overreaction. I am not denying that in any way, nor am I denying that Aphrodite did not have fair reason. Like, you know, she is in a marriage against her own will, and there is no love there, and she is the goddess of love. What's she going to do? And I did see some, I did in one conversation with someone, they referred to it as slut shaming, which I think is a very interesting kind of modern interpretation of it, which is valid. I think it's a very fair way of reading it. But what I would say to take away from it, if you go back and read it, what I take away from it, what I find interesting, is that in that moment, I think Hephaestus is denied his agency. Because the reason he is doing that is not only because he's hurt or whatever. I mean, he is clearly by a great degree. But fundamentally, what he's doing by entrapping them and getting all the other gods to come and see, he's trying to get his dowry back, which by the standards of the day, by the kind of the worldview of the day, he is entitled to, by all accounts, because his wife has cheated on him. And so he's demanding that Zeus give his dowry back. But Zeus doesn't want to have anything to do with it. He just refuses outright to give it to him. The other male gods are obviously having a whale of a time, because they are, A, laughing at him, Hephaestus, that is, obviously, for being cuckolded. They are obviously goggling over Aphrodite. And they're also laughing at Ares, I think is worth saying, because he got captured by Hephaestus. So they find the whole thing hilarious. The goddesses don't come to see, because they are, I think the translation says, shamed, but you know, whatever that means. That just I think obviously you could also interpret it as they're just like, this stupid male bullshit.
Yeah, true. Better than
anyway. But yeah, it turns out that Poseidon in the end has to kind of say, look, I will pay you the value of that dowry in order so that you let them go. Because again, binding is a very serious thing. And if you bound Aphrodite in particular, I mean, Ares and Aphrodite both being bound is a bad thing, but mm-hmm. Aphrodite in particular, this goddess of fertility and love and all these things that are very, very vital for the world to keep on going, is kind of like, no, we can't keep her trapped forever, because when she's bound, when gods are bound, they're powerless, or mm-hmm. they start to become powerless. So that's the key thing. You can't leave them like that. That's one of the few ways in which an Olympian can truly be friend. So that's why they're like, no, that's a bad thing. But the thing is that he has to go through all that just to get a fraction of what his other kind of kin could easily have demanded just on the spot and would have mm-hmm. likely gotten. I always like to propose that if you were to reverse Ares and Hephaestus's roles in that mm-hmm. story, do you think the Greeks would tell it in the same way? And I think the answer is not. I think if that had happened another way around, the Greeks would have told a very different story. And so it's just, most of all, I just want you to take away from it a thought exercise in which you think about the ways in which they are approaching him and in his being. And obviously, while I don't think his impairment is the sole reason for that, and again, it does not absolve him of his mm-hmm. attitude or of his nature and in other ways. And I mean, we can get onto his relationship with Athena as well in a moment. Mm-hmm. But it is still something I think worth bearing in mind, that this is in a reality, he is denied that kind of agency that his other kin would have had. Mm-hmm. So I don't in any way advocate that you, again, sympathize for him, because he's mm-hmm. a god. He doesn't need your sympathy. And also he's done plenty ill himself. But it's more just so that when you read that story, when you think about it, I do ask that you think about it with that lens in mind. And mm-hmm. recognize that you can also kind of draw that distinction between his embodiment of disability and his other kind of natures, if it will, because sometimes it does unfortunately become the case that the two kind of almost get intermeshed too much, and therefore people kind of, that's the takeaway from it. And mm-hmm. and that's obviously very harmful. So mm-hmm. I would ask that people kind of, if you go back and read it now, Do keep that in mind and think about it and be more critical about that kind of side of the story. Because if you think about it, like the fact that he went to that extent just to get that thing says mm-hmm. a lot about his relationship with the other gods, I think, and his mm-hmm. situation in Olympus, that the only places that he ever seems to feel happy are in his forge and on Lemnos. Those are the only two places that he ever seems to feel contented. Otherwise, he's always kind of in a foul mood, or at least he is in a mood that suggests tension. Mm-hmm. So that's just interesting from my point of view anyway.
No, I think that's, I mean, important and also so true, you know, because mm. even just making that straight comparison of like, if the roles were reversed with Ares, would that have happened? And you're completely right. They wouldn't have happened. Mm. And so, you know, so there's like an inherent connection in that just by presenting it that way, where it's, yeah, no one would have mm. come in and laughed at Ares, you know, mm. in that way. And it is really presented as something funny, like something mm. what a ridiculous thing Hephaestus tried to do. Mm. You know, what was he thinking that he could get away with that, and mm. things like that, that I do think, yeah, the connection certainly does need to be made, that it mm. wouldn't have happened to the other gods.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Goode. and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
There is, if I may just quickly jump in, please. There is another connection, because obviously that episode comes, I believe, from the Odyssey. That's when that occurs, if I remember.
Yes, but also in most detail, it's in the Homeric hymn to Aphrodite.
That's it. Thank you. But there is also in the Iliad, not to do with Hephaestus specifically, but I do think it's an interesting parallel. And I made this for my undergraduate thesis in... In the second book of the Iliad, obviously you have the council of the Achaeans where they're coming together after the withdrawal of Achilles, and they're all like, oh shit, what do we do? We've literally lost our best guy.
Yeah, we're fucked.
We're fucked. And they don't know what to do. So in that moment, there is actually a scene where a commoner called Pheris... I'm going to butcher this name, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I always Pheris, do, don't worry.
Pheristes. Who is essentially, he's an old soldier who now kind of serves the other soldiers, and he's a part of Odysseus's kind of very large entourage, if you will. But he is described as being physically monstrous and mentally insubordinate. So he is clearly described as in embodying what we would recognize as disability. And in this scene, he basically loses his rag and basically... Like Hephaestus, in a way, he loses his rag with everyone else around him, and he basically just tells them straight. He basically just says, Agamemnon, you done fucked up. Obviously, I'm paraphrasing here, but he essentially says, you're a fool for having taken Achilles' prize, and you've doomed us all, essentially. You've doomed this campaign because you did this silly thing. Now, everyone is so taken aback by this, that the only thing that can really be done, Odysseus kind of leaps into action and basically beats him black and blue. Because he spoke out against these superiors. He eventually scurries away, and everyone is said to have laughed. But this is an interesting thing, and this kind of comes back to what we were saying about reception. It's never clear exactly how the audience is supposed to take this. How are they supposed to respond to this? Are they supposed to respond to the fact that this physically monstrous man apparently, you know, spoke out of turn and got his ass handed to him by Odysseus? Or... is it supposed to point out the fact that it took this man to say something, to say what was true, that they were that those so-called heroes were left so stunned that the only thing they could do was beat him silly? Mm-hmm. So it's never clear whether these characters are actually supposed to be laughed at, or whether the laughter is more this kind of nervous sort of, oh crap, he's right, And I think I like to interpret that scene as Odysseus and the other heroes, and Agamemnon obviously being taken so aback that they're like, oh crap, he's right, you know, but god damn him for being right, and so they beat him up for it.
Well, yeah,
But yeah, yeah. In the same way, I think Hephaestus, obviously in his own nature, kind of does that within his own situation with the Olympians. He calls them out all the time for how they treat him, but obviously they just blow him off.
No, that's so true. I'd forgotten about that scene. I just pulled out my copy to look at it. I remember it now. Yeah, it's so true because, I mean, he's obviously right. You know, like it and everything will go on to prove that he is right. You know, we're only in this second book. So it's an interesting thing to wonder what the intention was there, because certainly in reading it now, you think like, okay, we're in book two. If you know the end of the story, you know that like this man is completely correct in his, you know, accusal of Agamemnon of just like fucking everything up, which he absolutely did. I mean, granted, like Achilles also is a deep overreactor.
Yes.
So like, not to suggest not to suggest that only Agamemnon is to blame. Both of these men are ridiculous.
Yes.
But at the same time, yeah, I mean, anyone who was listening to this story, I would imagine, would think like, oh, here is this man who, you know, is completely accurate and calling Agamemnon out. And, you know, but at the same time, as much as I think maybe, you know, maybe Odysseus and Agamemnon, whatever, like maybe they did. Well, Agamemnon could never appreciate that he was wrong, but Odysseus is supposed to be smart. So,
yes.
But at the same time, I think Odysseus is that cunning Odysseus in that way where while this speech is correct, and I think Odysseus probably knows, like he knows that Agamemnon shouldn't have done that and Agamemnon did fuck up, but he also knows that Agamemnon is the one who's more powerful, so he's going to beat the man senseless, because regardless of him being right, Odysseus is cunning. He's not only, you know, smart, he's not just going to go say like, oh, you're completely right, because he's kind of a dick, you know, like I love him, but he's an asshole and he's like super problematic fave, right?
Yeah.
Like, and so he's going to look at it and still say like, okay, well, my best way of staying alive is to beat this guy and tell Agamemnon that he was wrong when obviously he's right. And so, you know, again, I'm coming at it from a much more, I also like, I have a literary background, so I dive at these things of like, I have an English degree and we like to pick everything apart in addition to the myths. So, but of course, you know, the connection is obvious to be made of like, yeah, he's also explicitly described as all of these, you know, I forget the exact descriptions, but all of these things that
physically monstrous and mentally insubordinate is the word.
Perfect. Oh gosh, that's quite a phrase.
Indeed. Indeed.
Yeah, and so, you know, those aspects certainly like come into the way that he's treated, and maybe if it was, you know, Ajax coming in and saying all of these things, Odysseus probably wouldn't have beat him up. He also couldn't have. Ajax would have beat him. So, you know, it's all of those little implications, and it's such an interesting, I mean, it's just interesting, even, you know, from all of the different perspectives of looking at it and thinking about all of these characters. Anyway, I'm constantly thrilled with anyone bringing up any of these new ways of looking at any of these pieces.
There's always new ways of looking at these things. That's the wonderful things about myths is that they are, I think I said at one point in the past that they are essentially still living things, and they are constantly reshaped by our own retellings and interpretations of them, and that's what makes them so interesting. But it also means that there is so much to kind of pull out and to kind of look at across various translations and copies that have come down across the years. Because like one kind of interesting detail that changes in some variations of the Iliad, for example. When Thetis goes to Hephaestus to have the armor made by him for Achilles, in the quote-unquote original, so the more extant Greek versions, that is just something that he does for her, because obviously he's very endeared to her because of how she looked after him and cared for him. So he does that and he just gives it to her. In a later Roman version of the myth, again, 2nd century AD, the 2nd century AD just seems to come up. There seems to be a shift in attitude somewhere, because in that version, he essentially tries to coerce sex out of her in return for making... Yes, it is not something uncommon for the gods to do. Coercing sex in return for gifts is definitely not new. He's not the only one who's tried this sort of thing, but it is interesting that they make him do that, especially with his essentially adoptive mother. for all intents and purposes. Mm-hmm. That is a very interesting sort of conundrum there. And it's interesting why they add that in, and God knows as to why they may have decided to do that. But it is, again, in these various retellings, and I think that adds to sometimes how he's perceived as this kind of sexually frustrated God, even though in reality he is no less successful or disastrous than any of the other gods. Like, he is described as being very happily engaged to Egalia, the charity brightness.
Right. I always forget about that.
Yeah, and there is also, I can't remember the other one. Damn it. He's also described by Hesiod as being married to another lesser divinity. But that's the key thing as well, is that he gets married to younger, lesser divinities, which by implication of status, because usually the marriage is to the eldest. So that kind of suggests that he is of lesser status, or seen of lesser status, because he's marrying these goddesses of lesser status. But from the way I like to imagine it and interpret it, I doubt he would care too much. Like, I think, yeah, you know, having these partners who actively seem to value him. So that's the other thing to bear in mind. We talk a lot, whenever we talk about Hephaestus and we think about his relationships, we talk a lot about his frustrations and how it all goes wrong and stuff like that. But there are many other times where he clearly is shown to be quite happily married. So that is another thing to bear in mind. But that also kind of comes on to, I think, I mean, well, actually, before we get into that, you did ask that you wanted to talk a little bit about the automatons. So before we go off on too much of a tangent, because I was about to mention Athena.
Yeah, we can get into that.
Yeah, we'll get into that. But yeah.
Yeah, so the automatons and Talos too, because Talos is someone I want to dive into. I keep meaning to buy Adrian Mayer's book, Gods and Robots. I jotted that down when you mentioned the automatons because it spurred me to do it again. But yeah, like, let's talk about those and Talos, because he does. I mean, I think he also is part of creating Pandora too.
Yes, yes.
From clay and everything. Yeah, he's the craftsman god, so it makes sense. But I mean, yeah, please.
Yeah, there is so much to unpack there. And I mean, I come at it from a very interesting angle, especially the story of Pandora and how he makes her from clay, because I'm coming at this again as an Egyptologist. And in Egyptology, in the Egyptian myths, one of the origins of humanity is the potter god, Khnum, who literally makes man from straw and clay. And that's very interesting also from histories of the body and the mind, because it essentially implies that we are very malleable beings. We are able to be shaped and changed and molded into various things. And actually, those Near Eastern influences, because it spans into the Hittites and the Assyrians as well, actually some theorize that ties in with Hephaestus as well, and his creation of automatons and moving images, because that is a very kind of Near Eastern idea. Think of the Assyrian Lamassus, the big winged bulls that were gate guardians. Ooh. Or the same with lions as well, or any other like great and terrible beasts that you can imagine. They were created obviously to be protectors, but the idea for the ancients in their head is that these were animate things. If not in the literal sense of being able to move, then they embodied a spirit which was able to kind of do these horrible things to any enemies that tried to befell the gates. And actually, you do get, for Hephaestus, you do get stories, I think in the Odyssey, one story is about a palace that Odysseus goes to, and it's protected by dogs, bronze dogs that are said to have been made by Hephaestus.
Oh.
So Alcinous. Alcinous's dogs. Phaeacian king.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Oh,
yeah. So it's Phaeacia. And he marvels at these dogs that are like literally meant to be able to animate themselves to guard against insurgents. There is also a story from this paper is from the 1980s, so recent in kind of, you know, scholarship terms.
Yeah.
A recently excavated kind of, I don't know if it's ostraca or maybe just some sort of kind of written down statement. Essentially, it speaks of a bronze lion that Hephaestus made and buried on Lesbos. It's actually entombed there. And what I love about this paper is that it refers to it as the lesbian lion. So I cannot help but imagine like this lion wrapped in the lesbian pride flag and Sappho riding on the back of it, chasing off
Hell
any men who try to come
on
to the island.
Slur Island. Yeah.
Slur Island, yeah. Yeah, no, that's just great. But yes, he essentially gets attested as having making these things. And I do think that's an interesting kind of one of his many feats, is not only because, mm-hmm. like I said earlier, he's able to give life to inanimate things, but that life is not always kind of in terms of strict animation, like being able to move. They can. I mean, Talos is a great example of that. But mm-hmm. it is also just in the terms of that they almost encase that fire. They put that inside of them, and that mm-hmm. is kind of what empowers them to do all these kind of terrible things to anyone who tries to do anything nasty to the thing that they're defending, be that a house yeah. or an actual city or a place in the case of Lesbos. You know, this lion is actually, like, from the description that's given of it, it doesn't actually animate, as in physically animate. That's why it's buried in the ground. But the idea is that right. it's buried in the ground, and it does encase this fire. So basically any ill that comes to the island is going to face the ill of the lion.
Yeah.
And that is, again, it's a very Near Eastern thing, a very Near Eastern magic thing as well, this idea of statues or kind of monuments that imbue this sort of power. So that's very interesting. And it reminds you just how interconnected, obviously, the world is. Mm-hmm. And something that often gets hotly debated, even today. Like, I mean, everyone made the big hoo-ha over Bernal's Black Athena back in the 80s, and how he obviously tried to draw the connection between Egypt and the Near East and Greece, and tried to kind of dispel this idea that that classical Greece somehow just kind of came out of the ether, like all of a sudden 5th century Athens was just there, you know, of all the enlightenment that some old men apparently had, but yeah. the
white men,
old white men indeed,
yeah,
but the obviously that has since been picked apart, because he is kind of wading into this with not too much grounding in those areas. But it doesn't take away from the overall point that these things are more interconnected than people kind of really thought, and the fact that, you know, there is a lot of influence that obviously just comes over, because the Greeks obviously in reality are traders, seafarers by nature. So they're all over the shot. You obviously Naucratis in Egypt, you have obviously in the Levant as well, in obviously Asia Minor in Turkey. They're all over, and so they are interacting with these people. No one exists in a vacuum. So in that same way, these ideas and these embodiments that come to when we think about the automatons, and when we think about Hephaestus as well, you know, they mm-hmm. are interconnected, and it's always fascinating to draw the combinations between the two.
Yeah, well, and because I mean that leads me to Talos, right? Which is the like enormous robotic automaton guy that he creates to protect Crete, and so I mean my problem is I don't know enough about, you know, the Eastern ones. I always want to make very clear to my listeners the connections, because I think that's important, even though I don't know enough about their history or mythology. But I mean, even the Greeks made it clear they had all of these connections. It's you know, the idea, the, you know, placing whiteness upon Greece and Rome and making them be this like bubble that they existed in, that was like, you know, this like white Western civilization invention bubble is, you know, wild and racist and so troubling. But it's, you know, even they made it so clear, like, you know, that's something that's placed upon them later. But they knew, like, you know, they took their language, they say, mythologically from Cadmus of the Phoenicians, and their connections to Egypt are, you know, huge and great and, you know, talked about so much, and North Africa, all of that. And, you know, and then so, but to bring it back to what you're saying about this connection to the bronze statues and automatons, that's fascinating, because Talos is on Crete, which is obviously, you know, the closest Greek island to Egypt, and had the most, especially certainly like in, you know, the much earlier, they had so many connections to Egypt through trade and through everything, because they were so far south and such a big island. And so, I mean, that connection there is something I'd never made before, of the, you know, the connection to the East and Hephaestus's creation of this enormous bronze man to protect the island. Like, that's such a that adds another layer to that, and so fascinating. And what you said about the fire within them as being their creation, their life force kind of thing, is an additional, I mean, fascinating, but also makes that explicit connection both to his status as craftsman god and god of fire and all of that. And yeah, I think that doesn't get talked enough about. You know, it is kind of all about his, his anger and his bitterness towards Aphrodite and Hera. And I'm certainly guilty of that. I'll absolutely own up. It comes out of my childhood love of Aphrodite that's never gone away. And like, that's always been my goddess. And so I immediately go to those things. And also, I like Aphrodite and Ares, and so I'm like, Hephaestus, you're such an asshole. Like, all of these things. And like, he is. But also that is something that it connects immediately to a thing that I try to do on the podcast so much, which is not talk about these stories as if that they were, you know, any kind of, I want to use the word truth because it seems to make the most point right now, that it's not like it's a story that happened and therefore it is an objective truth.
Yeah, no.
It is, you know, yeah, like you're saying, you know, myths are living things, they're malleable and they change over time between sources. But also the thing I like to talk about most lately, the more and more I learn about it, is who told the stories, whose stories got written down, and whose stories that were written down survived. Mm-hmm. And so you have this, that is, I always talk about it in terms of the women, but I think it's also equally applicable to somebody like Hephaestus, you know, and I wonder what stories we might not have of him. Mm-hmm. You know, what stories were told within, you know, circles of ancient Greek people, you know, be they disabled or not, or, you know, I mean, but I think especially maybe stories from people who had similar experiences to Hephaestus, or just disabilities of their own, or, you know, various things like that, and what stories they might have told about him, and how maybe they would have connected to him in such a positive way, and those things we don't have, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a fascinating thing to think about, just the things we don't have, and how that then connects to somebody like Hephaestus, who has been so affected by the stories that we do have, which, you know, while they acknowledge his importance, but also definitely, you know, make really bold claims about the way he was treated by the Olympians and, you know, his own just personality and everything in there.
Yeah, I think, as you said, you always have to think about what's missing, and mm-hmm. and again, these stories, for whom and by whom were they created? I think obviously in that sense becomes even more complicated to untangle, especially when we're thinking about his relationship with anger and how he displays it, because I was very fortunate in my final year of undergrad to take a module with a wonderful academic, a classic Greek scholar called Dr. Riet van Bremen, and she does a lot on Greek youth. That's really her specialty, and a lot of the study of Greek youth ties in emotions, especially because Greek youth, which predominantly, unfortunately, refers to Greek men, she always laments, every class she would lament the fact that it was majoritively that we had to talk about men and not women, because we only unfortunately get very kind of extant sources on young women. Mm-hmm. But anyway, this young men have this very intricate relationship with anger as well. They are almost expected in some ways to kind of display this anger at as the kind of inheritors of the cities and of the spaces that they occupy when they come of age. Once they get through the Ephebeia, this is like the coming of age ritual, and they become adults. They are expected to kind of utilize that anger to essentially gain their right as male citizens to protect their city, to protect their land, and obviously to, you know, whatever else. But it's interesting, again, going to Hephaestus and his anger. His anger is almost kind of the over kind of estimation of that anger, and he's almost the dangerous side of it. And it is interesting how you could interpret some kind of interpretations of Greek interpretations of disability. I, in my view, do seem to reflect this as well. Like, the disabled man is very much a threat to the health of the polis. You know, his both in terms of his physical body, but also in terms of his anger and his bitterness. And this kind of goes on into the Hellenic age, where you see these kind of statues, which are referred to in the literature today as grotesques. These are kind of terracotta figurines of mostly men. There are some women, but there are mostly men who are what we would say is like disfigured, or, you know, deformed, or horrible words like that. And they show like hunchbacks or lame feet, as they would say in the literature, so clubbed feet, or any other, or sometimes dwarfism is one thing that pops up. And they're often shown to have these kind of wild sort of expressions, and they've been interpreted various ways. And some of them are very clearly scowls, their anger. And again, these were made for elite men to have in their household. They were placed in the household, and no one's really sure exactly what they were for. Some people think they were for humor. Others think that perhaps they were there because it was meant to be a reflection of like, you know, this is not what you are, like, you know, this is what you could be if you were a bitter person or whatever, so you should be grateful or anything like that. There's loads of different ways you can interpret it. I'm not exactly sure how to interpret them, but what I do think they were is that they were meant to be reflections on that. And in that, disability has always been society's kind of way of reflecting upon itself. Like, we always think of disability as the other, but to me, disability is a universal human constant, which has always been there, not just by the nature of human, how humans are, by their biological material. We our bodies are malleable and they change all the time, both in terms of their own DNA, but also just in terms of our vital organs and our limbs and things like that. So disability will be, it was there at the beginning and it will be there at the end. I give you that promise now. But I think in terms of human society, it has always existed in the mind's eye of society, because disabled people are the pale mirror to that reality of humanity, which some societies will accept, some will reject, some will be somewhere in the middle. It's never a black and white thing. So in this case, I think those grotesques are a similar thing, where they are a kind of reflection on this kind of, especially when you think of the Hellenic Age, which obviously is painted by obviously the conquests of Alexander and the aftermath of that, the competition between the various states that were born from his empire. And it was a very violent time for all intents and purposes. And so that is why in the art of the age, there is this turn towards art that is more expressive, but also more violent in a way. It's kind of more twisted, more emotion, and their faces are actually becoming expressive now, whereas in the classical kind of style of art, it was much more muted in terms of its expressions. So in that same way, I do think maybe Hephaestus, especially as time went on and as transmissions changed, maybe his relationship with the other gods, the Olympians, is supposed to be a reflection of that attitude of the kind of the need to keep a pure and well maintained center of order and of a standard of being that these kind of disabled individuals' embodiments kind of are the kind of pale to that norm. And so they kind of keep them close because they want to make sure they're not a threat, but obviously keep them at a distance enough so that they can never be fully a part of it. Again, that's just, you know, a very surface level reading. So it's far more complex than that. And there are many great scholars who are working on that to look at the intricacies of that. But that's like, it is far more complex than just what you would see on the surface. And in that same way, that obviously goes doubly true for the relationship with the rest of the world and just the ideas that are being transmitted. I think it is very interesting, of course, that a lot of what Hephaestus does, like with Talos on Crete, and a lot of the other things he does in that kind of area of the Greek world, is obviously around where a lot of volcanic activity is happening. So this is obviously, to the Greeks, I think this is obviously a place where they see him as being a very active person. I mean, I think to the Romans, obviously with Sicily, I think the saying was that whenever Etna was erupting or was close to erupting, they interpreted that as obviously him being furious with Venus. So that was just, yes, I think the saying goes like, obviously Venus has yet again gone off with someone else. But it's that volcanic activity. This is a, I think often what we struggle with is that when we go to these places today, like you can visit Lesbos, you can visit Lemnos, where actually their international airport is called Hephaestus, which I think is really cool. Yeah, it is.
I think that's awesome. Makes me so happy, and now I have to go. Oh, shucks.
But yeah, if you go to these places, we obviously go there, and they're beautiful. They're scenic, and but most of the volcanoes now are extant. They aren't active anymore, with the exception of one or two. They're sleepy. We go there now, and this is true of any landscape you go to. It's the same with Egypt. This is something Egyptologists always have to remember. You go to the landscape now, you don't realize how violent it was. Like, you know, these eruptions were happening on a far more regular basis than we can kind of imagine. And that would like kind of shape communities, and it not just in terms of obviously their makeup and how they had to move and live, but also just in the way that they saw the world. And so I think as well that obviously does shape their relationship with their personification of that Hephaestus. And they do see, and that's again maybe perhaps where his violent temperament comes from, but maybe also where his embodiment comes from. Maybe it's the fact that these volcanoes, these violent fissures in the earth, you know, on the earth's surface, you know, are what he embodies. He embodies this kind of violent embodiment, and I do think there are many different avenues to which you could take it. And so therefore, by extension, these automatons, how he's wielding this power, this violence to create these wondrous machines, mm-hmm. that, you know, even by his other like kin standards, like they're like, wow, this is awesome, but also very scary. Like, again, this is part of the reason why they kind of want him in Olympus, because they don't want him sitting on his own building all these automatons, because that could be a serious threat to them.
I mean, he is a serious threat to them in general, his abilities and his skill. Mm-hmm.
Which is why I think it's so interesting. And he is a far more interesting character. And just to go back very briefly, because you said, you know, obviously you come at this obviously being such a stand for Aphrodite, which is fine. And I do want to again make it very clear, you're allowed to not like Hephaestus. I'm not trying to say you have to, like, you know, give him all the credence now or feel any sympathy for him. I know I keep repeating this, but it's more that I hope that from this conversation what you'll take away is that he's a far more complex character.
Ugh, nerds, as always, thank you so much for listening. Again, I absolutely love this conversation. We just talked about so much, which is why next week you are going to hear part two, where we talk more about Hephaestus' status as a volcano god and what that means for him as a character, a little bit more about disability in the ancient world, some connections with Egypt and the East, reception of Hephaestus and how he has been changed over time from what he was in antiquity and how the ancient Greeks would have seen him to how he is depicted in pop culture today and everything that comes along with that. Honestly, so much more fascinating stuff to come. Thank you all so much. I am Liv and I love this shit.
My name is Johnny B. Goode, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.